Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Some say the civil unrest triggered by the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor killings by police have led to a national reckoning with racism and possibly to a more genuine and lasting healing of our country's long festering racial wounds. At the heart of that process is communication, having and learning from conversations that make us uncomfortable, an airing of grievance, a growth in enlightenment and understanding. In this edition of Eastern Standard, snapshots of the past, present, and future of the American struggle to achieve racial harmony. And we'll begin with the past.
Good afternoon. My name is Lindrell Blackwell. I'm a Bourbon County and live in Winchester at this time. And I'd like to thank Ms. Sally Showalter for being here and Mr. Jim Bannister to have a family discussion.
It took 120 years, but on a recent mid-July afternoon, a remarkable conversation took place between two people, a white woman and a black man, seated facing each other, socially distanced, in the basement of the Hopewell Museum in Paris, Kentucky.
First thing I want to say is how sorry I am that my family had anything to do with a loss of your family member for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And that's why I'm here today. I just want to have this conversation, this family conversation, to talk about the things that happened 120 years ago and hopefully to bring them to light so that people here in Paris and people across Kentucky can understand that these things happened and we can put our head in the sand and pretend like they never did happen, but they happened in families where you least expect it. So that's why we're here today.
I just want to thank you for coming, to the front with this. This means so much to me and my family. I've got three children raised. They were born right here in Bourbon County. I've got five grandkids, and I've got two great-grandkids. And this is so important because now they need to know everything that's happened so they can maybe do something about it.
It is among the scores of extrajudicial mob lynchings of African Americans that took place in Kentucky during the Jim Crow era.
I'm here, Mr. Bannister, because I learned about 6 years ago that my family had been involved in an incident in Bourbon County in 1900-1901.
The incident in question was an alleged attempted robbery of Showalter's great-grandmother in Paris early in December of 1900. And the subsequent lynching 3 months later of Mr. Bannister's great-uncle, George Carter.
I never could get no details. The older people in Bourbon County, much older than me, I would ask them, do you have any info you remember? No, I kind of remember it, but that was it. You couldn't get anything.
Showalter explained that she had been researching for a book about her grandfather. He had abandoned her grandmother soon after her mother's birth, and she enlisted the help of a friend who was a former investigative reporter.
Late one evening, about 7 o'clock, I'll never forget it, I got an email from this same friend of mine, and he had stumbled across a newspaper article out of California about Mary Lake Board and this incident that had happened to her on the bridge on 2nd Street. And he had uncovered the whole story about George Carter. I believe he's your great-great uncle. Is that correct?
George Carter, yes.
Who had been accused of, the word was assaulting my great-grandmother. It appears in some of the newspaper tellings that assault could have been an attempted purse snatching, is what we call it these days. Eventually, there's a long story here, and we'll talk about it more. I won't go into all the details, but as you know, George Carter was eventually hung on the courthouse, in front of the courthouse here in Paris, for this supposed or alleged crime against my great-grandmother.
Born in 1941, Bannister, as a young boy, rarely heard mention of the lynching of his great-uncle George Carter.
Seems like the people in that time, those times, were like intimidated, not to mention what had gone on before.
But his family's perspective of what happened in the winter of 1901 finally began to emerge. Jim was then 10 years old.
My grandmother, she told me, she said, sit down, I have something to explain to you. Sit down. She was telling me that her brother, well, my grandmother was born September 23rd, 1894. And I think George was like born probably 15, 20 years before her. So she was telling me everything that went down. Then she got to the part where she like said, well, they lynched my brother. And I couldn't understand because, you know, she said, they lynched him. She told me what happened. She says, over on Pleasant Street, right down the street here, it was a feed store down there. And I understand that he went there that morning to get chicken feed for the chickens. And this lady was perhaps behind him a few feet, and he noticed her behind him, so he acknowledged her and bowed and tipped his cap to him, and that was it. They took him there without any more to do. There wasn't anything else said about him, but I understand that he was lynched over there on that railroad trestle where the railroad runs right along Pleasant Street. It runs right over into Stoner. And that's where he was lynched at. And they carried him from Pleasant Street, where the railroad trestle was, across the street, across Main Street, over to High Street. And that's where they hung him off of that gate. And the gate and everything still visible is sitting there. She was saying how many people was just gathering and nothing was done about it, but they hung him on that gate, and that's what I was told about it.
Accounts differ in details concerning what happened on that chilly winter evening in 1901. Time has its way with memory. We have as a record only the purple prose of newspaper accounts of that era, newspapers owned and operated by the local white establishment. The February 8, 1901 edition of the Bourbon News reported that a George Carter had been brought before an examining trial on a charge of attempting to assault his sister-in-law. Mr. Carter was ordered jailed pending trial for that alleged offense. According to this account, a rumor was circulating to the effect that it was Carter who also had assaulted Showalter's great-grandmother inside the wooden-covered bridge over 2nd Street in Paris in December, and that despite the absence of any evidence to support this accusation, he probably would be lynched. Between the publication of that February 8th article that rumored the upcoming lynching and the actual act that Sunday night, Mrs. Board evidently was shown a photo of Mr. Carter and confirmed that he was the attacker. And her son, Sally's grandfather, then 8 years old, was taken to the jail and identified Mr. Carter in person. Even though Mrs. Board and her son identified Carter as the attacker, the physical description of the attacker that had been reported a few months earlier, burly, weighing 200 pounds, does not match that of a thin and wiry George Carter. So, was George Carter hanged because he was jailed for a crime the public thought was similar to what had happened to Mrs. Board? Did Mary Lake Board and Lyons Board truly recognize Carter 2 months after the assault? Or was he just a convenient and innocent target of vengeance? In any case, according to a subsequent article in the Bourbon News, on the evening of Sunday, February 10, 1901, a mob of 50 men overpowered the county jailer, took George Carter from his cell, marched him along Main Street to the Bourbon County Courthouse, and hanged him, not once, but twice after the rope broke during the first attempt, from the arch of the iron courthouse gate. This account differs from what Bannister had been told by his grandmother, that the initial lynching took place at the railroad trestle near the old jail. But in any case, photographs of Mr. Carter's lifeless body hanging from that gate leave no doubt about his fate. Little is known about what became of Carter's wife and two daughters, ages 2 and 7 months.
So the question is, will forever be, I guess, yeah. You know, was this gentleman the same person? How did they identify him? They asked my grandfather at 8 years old to go to the jail and point his finger at him. So my grandfather at 8 years old may well, he was with his mother on the bridge when the incident happened. It's possible he recognized him and he thought it was the same gentleman. It's possible he didn't recognize him, didn't know, but just decided he would do what the adults around him expected of him. Or it's possible that he knew absolutely it was not the same man as the one who had assaulted his mother. But there were these people waiting expectantly for him to say it was. So that's the burden I live with, that the incident happened to my great-grandmother. My grandfather at 8 years old was asked to confirm that George Carter was the gentleman. I have no idea what he knew about the incident, how he responded to being asked to do that.
You put a lot of pressure on an 8-year old.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never could. Anything about it. I mean, I couldn't get no discussion. Nobody knew about it. I'm talking about older people in the community. And if something like that happens, outrageous in the community, everybody knows. But it was an intimidation factor there for somewhere. And they wouldn't talk.
Why talk about this now? Why dredge up the past?
We haven't had these conversations, so we haven't corrected this problem. We still watch this day in and day out, where Black folks are accused of things they haven't done, or they lose their lives over some minor infraction. And we have to talk about it.
You have to talk about it. If you don't, you'll never, it'll be just like it is, like, 1901. And this is, 2020 is, a century and 2 decades ago. I mean, it's happening, again.
It feels like perhaps over the last 2 or 3 months, there has been a movement forward, and we just want something positive to come out of that. And I hope that there can be conversations like this. I hope that perhaps the community of Paris can have an honest conversation about this history that we have, and in some way recognize formally that your great uncle lost his life, that there was another gentleman here who lost his life in a similar incident in 1889, and that there may be additional ones that we just don't have the stories about. So I don't know, if there's an opportunity to do that, but I would love to see that happen so that there's a larger conversation.
In our community, we have a tendency of saying, we don't talk about that. It's too painful. And over the years, centuries, however, the stories that get passed down, nobody wants to talk about it. As soon as somebody wants to talk, people start shutting down. As they get a little feisty and finicky, I laugh, and I told a friend of mine, when people tell stories, I'm a 90% researcher, 10% believer. Because people will exaggerate the story for what they've been told. But if you can, you have the research and the knowledge, so you got a lot of information, and Mr. Bannister's got the family history. But I think when people don't talk, that's when all the problems happen. And the disinterest in the families come, and it gets lost in the wayside.
It's like that song. Marvin Gaye's got a song. It's 50 years old, but it's prevalent. He says, what's going on? And it's still the same way. And we don't know yet.
You can listen to the entire conversation between Sally Showalter and Jim Bannister online at esweku.org. Something's going on. A new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll finds voters in growing numbers believe that Black and Hispanic Americans are discriminated against, and a majority, 56%, holds the view that American society is racist. 71% believe that race relations are either very or fairly bad, and that's a 16-point increase since February. Something else going on right now is in its early stages in Lexington, where Mayor Linda Gorton has established a Commission for Racial Justice and Equality. Creation of the commission is the city's response to protests triggered by the police killings of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Breonna Taylor in Louisville. Since those deaths and the protests that has followed, officials across the country have grappled with how to respond to conversations about policing, race, and the legacy of slavery. The Mayor's Commission is co-chaired by the University of Kentucky historian Gerald Smith and Rosalind Akins, an educator for more than 30 years at Leestown Middle School and Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, and executive director of the Black Males Working, or BMW, Academy. Dr. Smith and Ms. Akins join us on conference cell phones from Pilgrim Baptist Church in Lexington, where Dr. Smith is pastor. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So,
thank you for having me.
You bet. And that polling that I mentioned indicates that in recent months, the needle has kind of moved a great deal, in fact, in clearly identifying that we as Americans have an issue with racism in this society. Do you agree, and do you believe this shift can be sustained?
Well, I definitely agree that there is racism in this country. I am also the director of the BMW Academy, which is an all-male program whose mission is to educate, motivate, and activate the potential for excellence that lies within every African-American male. I've been blessed to travel across the world with these young men. And I remember us being in New York City. I was on my way to take them to Broadway to see a play, and they were dressed to the nines, bow tie, looking good, smelling good on our way. And we stopped in Times Square to take a picture. I had a professional photographer there. And after we took our picture ready to walk to Broadway to take to see the play, someone came up to me and asked me, when are they going to sing and dance? And it just took me back. I said, this is an academic group, an educational group. They're on their way to see a play. And they said, well, we still don't understand why they can't sing or dance. And so where I've traveled through personal experiences and especially taken young, gifted Black males all across the world, we have come in to so much racism. First of all, the stereotyping. What kind of sports do you play? Or if a large group go into the mall, people grab their purses. Just the negativity. And I think that we are going to take advantage of this opportunity of what's going on here in Lexington and throughout the nation. And I pray this is not just a moment, but a movement.
Okay, let me turn to Dr. Smith. Dr. Smith, do you feel that this conversation that we're talking about that has occurred since the protests began, do you feel that this time this can be sustained over time and we can get somewhere with it?
Oh, yeah. I'm very optimistic and hopeful that this movement is going to be sustained. I believe when I look at the diversity of those who are involved, the number of demonstrations throughout the nation, there is a level of commitment and determination that is in place now that will definitely move forward. So people are looking for solutions. People want action. They're tired of waiting. They're tired of the deflections, the defense that have come from a number of whites in various circles. And now, you know, people are looking for change. I mean, we have a society that is much more diverse, a generation of young people who are more educated and who are now more integrated in terms of their social lives and experiences. And so what I'm encouraged by is the number of young white people who are out there in the streets who are chanting Black Lives Matter. This is something that we have not seen in a couple of generations.
So this commission has been created, just now getting to work. Can you tell us about the plan ahead, the agenda, if it's come together yet? What's it look like?
Well, the main purpose of the commission is to assemble diverse community members to listen, discuss, and create empowering solutions that dismantle systemic racism here in Fayette County. And so that's the general purpose. We have some guiding principles that the subcommittees are looking at as we take on this challenge. And so that's it. They're going to acknowledge, they're going to ask, they're going to address. And last but certainly not least, we want action to come out of this commission.
And I take it this will all be done in a spirit of transparency?
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, that's, transparency and accountability essential pieces in this whole process. And we say transparency because all of the subcommittee meetings are broadcast on YouTube. There are actually five subcommittees, which include racial equity, education and economic opportunity. That's the second. The third is health disparities. The fourth is law enforcement, justice, and accountability. And the fifth subcommittee is housing and gentrification. As a matter of fact, you know, they have been meeting over the course of the past 3 weeks. There are two vice chairs that are working with each of the subcommittees, and we stay in close communication with the vice chairs. Members of the community have complete access to those meetings. They can view the meetings live. They are posted on the government's website. They are also recorded, so you can go back and take a look at those meetings, those virtual meetings that are being held weekly.
When do you expect to begin reporting your findings and the findings of these committees?
Originally, the mayor would like some type of report by the end of August. That we will have something for her and the council by the end of August. And let me add about the transparency and trying to get community, you know, involved. There will also be three community forums where people have an opportunity to ask questions, send in questions via email. And that's going to take place within the next week to 2 weeks. That they will be notified, and everyone. We want everyone to feel like they have a voice in this as we prepare our report and take it to the mayor.
Black faith leaders in Lexington say that steps have been made in the right direction, but it's not enough. And, of course, the commission's mission is to make it enough to get there. Would you agree that there have been some advancements in the way of legal and institutional reforms?
To some extent, yes. And no, they have been short and long coming. And, you know, what we want to see is some substantive steps taking place. And that's, you know, what we hope to accomplish through this commission. You know, we believe that the mayor is committed to making significant changes in this community. I think it's quite evident in the formation of this commission and the number of individuals. I think we have more than 60 individuals comprising the entire commission from various walks of life. So we have a depth and breadth of knowledge and experience that is going to dig deeper into this community and excavating our understanding of an acknowledgement of racism in Lexington and Fayette County.
Let's look at a few of the issues that you're likely going to be touching on. And one of them has to do with one of the popular outgrowths of the protests that have been going on, calls for defunding police departments or reallocating portions of funds to strengthen social services and relieve police of those duties. Do you see the commission looking into that?
I think the commission is looking in all areas. That's why we have a specific committee called Law Enforcement, Justice, and Accountability, and they will be looking at all areas and making suggestions for that. So that's why that's a specific committee that has a major responsibility as they look at data, as they look at all types of things that is taking place. And so whatever comes out, we want it to be the best for Lexington.
Yeah. In a real sense, this is almost like an audit for, you know, not only the police department, you know, quite frankly, but not only the police department. I mean, there's going to be a thorough overview looking at housing and gentrification in the city and examining racial equity and education and economics. And parsing through all of that, each of the committee members are examining various reports and policies, procedures, practices, those things that will hopefully help us to identify both systemic and systematic practices in this community that reflect the continuing structural inequalities that have been going on for generations.
Well, I know that state laws and police collective bargaining agreements are roadblocks to creating a citizens' review board. But do you expect the commission to look at alternatives to that, some sort of oversight over the police department?
Yes, everything's on the table. I mean, we're not one of the things that we've encouraged each of the subcommittees to do is to not necessarily focus on what we can't do, but what we must do. And so looking at it from that angle, you know, we're not going to allow any barriers to preclude us from offering up the kind of solutions that we think will move Lexington forward.
It's going to be interesting to follow up with you all later on as you've really begun to sink your teeth into this work. But I wonder, it's often said that awkward conversations can lead to change. Do you agree with that? Are you experiencing awkward conversations in this work? And do you sense that they may result in real change?
Definitely. Awkward conversations do lead to change in the fact that you have to have those courageous conversations. If you don't have the courageous conversations, then change cannot take place. And so we are having those conversations. The subcommittees are having them. We want the community, as they get involved, to have those courageous conversations, because that is how systemic racism can bring about a change in Lexington. We must have the courageous conversations. Even if it makes you uncomfortable, you've got to have the conversations.
Yeah, in fact, we're hoping that the conversations become uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want, you know, a rose garden. I mean, we want to dig deep. When I say dig deep, that means that we need to have the uncomfortable conversations, the tough talk. You know, people cannot be afraid to speak up and share their views and opinions. And this is not only those on the commission, but definitely people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are several voices that we're hearing, but we're also very mindful of the silent majority, if you want to call them that, and what side of history they're going to be on.
You know, is it just me, or do you sense that as we have these so-called awkward conversations, they become less awkward?
Definitely. Because then you get to see me for who I am and not have those stereotypes or preconceived notions that you have about a person. That breaks down barriers when you have those awkward conversations, and it allows you to know me for the person I am, and not because of the color of my skin that you misjudge me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just the sense that even though it may be an awkward conversation, we'll also find out how much we have in common.
Right.
And in order to reach common ground, you know, we've got to go through, we've got to trod that rough ground.
You are both educators, and Kentucky just hired a new education commissioner who has a track record for attention to diversity. And I wonder what sorts of changes or reforms you envision or anticipate. Education is so key to all of this, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. The first thing that I'm going to look at with this new commissioner is those he puts around himself. What is his administration going to look like? Who are the folks that he hires to put in key positions? Will those folks be diverse? If you do something within your small group that you have, then that lets others know that you are for diversity. So I want to see what he's going to do right within KDE, the Kentucky Department of Education, as he hires and brings people in. Is he a voice of diversity by who he hires?
Yeah, I'm looking at that. I'm also concerned about the recruitment of African-American school teachers, but also curriculum. I think the curriculum is vitally important, considering the fact of where we are and, you know, how many young people down through the years have been miseducated. And because of that miseducation is one of the reasons that people are so obstinate about these Confederate statues and the like, because they have been miseducated. They have been indoctrinated to believe that those statues represent something that is actually not true.
Yes, and in fact, the curriculum in public schools back in the early 1900s up into the middle part of the century even included supplements that taught that very thing.
Yes.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the curriculum is important, and surely, given where we are as a nation right now, that will be at the top of the list in terms of something we must address today.
Black history shouldn't be taught just in February. It ought to be an
right.
Inclusive history, not an exclusive history.
one question before we wrap it up for each of you. When we distill this whole thing down to one thing, isn't it really all about the value of human dignity?
Absolutely. For too long, many African Americans have been dehumanized, and it's a lack of knowledge and a lack of not getting to know me as an individual or others as individuals. The fear that I see on people's faces when I take these young, gifted African-American males to the mall or to a museum or to places, and that's that stereotype that they have in their head. And so if you can accept me as your sister because of the person I am, then we will go a long way in tearing down a lot of the racism that's taking place in this country.
Yep, exactly. And I think that, something else that's going to come out of this commission is the number of anecdotal experiences that African-Americans have had dealing with implicit bias and microaggressions, and that some are very painful and tearful when they share their story, their encounters with the police, experiences in their neighborhoods, or not only that, but on their job. There are things that we share among ourselves, but the rest of the community needs to know how many times we've had to hold our nose and close our eyes and turn our head and accept some things that have been quite painful, not only for our generation, but for the generations that preceded us.
This is going to be so interesting to follow the work of the commission, and we look forward to doing that and revisiting with the two of you from time to time as things go along. Hopefully soon we'll be able to all get back into a studio where we're not on phones and things.
hope for that too.
Gerald Smith and Roz Akins, co-chairs of Lexington's new Commission on Racial Justice and Equality, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break.
The system has benefited so long and so well from disenfranchising a certain part of the population that it's hard to imagine that it would just willingly dismantle itself.
Former Kentucky Poet Laureate Frank X. Walker offers a vision of a future following today's more open and frank discussions about race, justice, and equality in America. He is Chris Begley's guest in the latest installment of our series, Future Tense. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Anthropologist and author Chris Begley is back with another in our series, Future Tense, discussions about where we are in this time of pandemic and civil and economic unrest and uncertainty, where we are going, what we have learned, and what it all means.
Well, today we have as our guest Frank X. Walker. Frank is a multidisciplinary artist, best known perhaps as a poet. He was a poet laureate of Kentucky from 2013 to 2015. He was a founding member of the Appalachian Poets, founder and editor of Pluck, the Journal of Appalachian Arts and Culture, professor of English at University of Kentucky, and much more. Well, welcome, Frank, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about where we find ourselves now. I mean, right now, of course, we're dealing with the pandemic, but we're also dealing with these sustained protests, calls for justice and change, at a scale that we have not seen in decades. Now, as an archaeologist, I see these radical transformations happen when a lot of these things come together. And I want to ask you what you think we're seeing now.
Well, I can tell you what I hope we're seeing. I hope we are squarely in the middle of a new civil rights movement, and some real sustainable change. And I think this collision of forces, it seems like a fair way to describe what's happening, but I think for somebody on this end of it, things have been colliding my whole life. And, one of my biggest questions is, you know, why haven't we seen this level of change before?
Yeah, that's a question I have too. And I wonder, is it because of the pandemic, or did it take something that really slowed everything down or forced us to think about, you know, radical change to really start to think about change?
You know, I'm not a scientist, but I suspect, as a poet, that they're all connected, that the pandemic did slow everything down by forcing people to quarantine themselves and spend time with themselves and their families and confront their own humanity. And I think that after a while, maybe after the first month, we even got bored with television and electronic things. And I know in my household, we moved from indoors to outdoors and started gardening again, something we hadn't done in a long time. And we started paying attention to the world around us and purchased bird feeders and started feeding birds and feeling a part of the ecosystem in our neighborhood for the first time. And I think that if our house was an example of what's happening everywhere else, somehow that whole thing served to make us more human. And I think in our more human state, when confronted with yet another blatant, ugly, horrific murder captured on video and then broadcast widely, that it moved more people than usual. And it moved them in such a way that when the opportunity came to be part of expressing discontent, what you saw on the streets was not what people typically expect for a movement. I think people hearing about riots and hearing about protests expected all people of color, you know, but to look on TV and video and see that it was a multicultural, mostly young, but very impassioned set of protesters on the big screen, and they had no plans to go away. I think it changed a lot of things in the system, you know, because I think the people who would normally have shut that down immediately had to ask themselves if they would treat their own children the way they've treated other people over the years, the many years. And clearly some of them are saying the answer is no, because we've seen things like, you know, the agreement to defund the police in Minneapolis and a new anti-lynching bill that had been pushed forever and got zero traction, and things happening in almost every industry. First with the leadership acknowledging some wrongdoing and promising or committing to do something different. I've never seen that before in such a widespread way. And even seeing it, I'm not sure that I trust it. But I admit it feels like a start. It feels like it's real some days, and I just hope that we live long enough to to really enjoy it, because that is in question.
Yeah. You know, for me, looking at this in the midst of looking at what we've seen in the past, it really does look like this convergence of crises that could potentially create this change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've always been a prolific writer. You have 13 books that you've written or edited, over 100 publications and anthologies, dozens of, you know, readings and presentations. And I know that you've also been writing a lot during the last few months. And I wondered if you might read for us one that you've recently written called Mrs. Butterworth, Uncle Ben, and Aunt Jemima.
Sure, I'd love to. These new poems started out being pandemic poems, and then when the protests hit, they all became mostly about the protests. But This is in the second part of that structure. This is called Mrs. Butterworth, Uncle Ben and Aunt Jemima walk into a bar in America. Butterworth says, "I'm being repackaged." Ben says, "I'm being rebranded." Jemima says, "I remember when they branded my mama on her back." The bartender says, "I could stand in the middle of Main Street and kill somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters." Butterworth says, "Then I'll take 8 bullets in my sleep." Ben says, "Choke me to death with your knee." Jemima says, "Lock me in a holding cell and say I decided to hang myself." The bartender poured the drinks, said he felt threatened and was simply standing his ground. He said he thought the thug was reaching for a gun. The headline said, "Well-loved American foods resisted arrest, failed to comply, and were delicious while black." Butterworth's daughter said, "Here's to progress. We might finally get an anti-lynching bill." Ben's son said, "I'd rather they abolish qualified immunity." Jemima's kid said, "You know, they abolished slavery once. Then they hung my mama on that box."
Well, thank you. That's a powerful poem. And this, of course, comments on where we are. And when I hear you read that, part of what I'm hearing is some ambivalence or some skepticism, really, of the degree to which some of these changes that we're seeing are as profound as they purport to be.
Yeah, I would say, you know, that comes out of a well-earned distrust for the system. You know, I think that the system has benefited so long and so well from disenfranchising a certain part of the population that it's hard to imagine that it would just willingly dismantle itself. So a lot of what I think I'm hearing are simply concessions, and all of the concessions came, you know, at the threat of violence, at the threat of losing something else that ultimately pointed to a bottom line. You know, I don't know that they represent a change in heart. I think that ultimately, that's where the change needs to happen. And it can't happen overnight. I mean, 6 months ago, none of this would have happened. But to see all the things that are happening in almost domino-like effect, you know, that feels like it's quick, also feels like they just want to get over with and get back to normal, get back to making a profit.
Yeah, the getting back to normal or getting back to something that we've moved from, you know, thinking about a post-pandemic world or a post-protest world, if that's, you know, something that would ever exist. Does something like this poem or the kinds of things you're producing or thinking about point to where we might be headed?
I'm not sure that it's designed to do that. You know, these poems are about what's happening right now on the ground. You know, but I think if you read it deeper, it says something about what has happened historically. It mentions the mistrust and the suspicion. You know, as it closes, Aunt Jemima's kid, you know, references slavery and the fact that slavery was officially abolished. But in reality, we know that, you know, slavery gave birth to what we now experience as a prison industrial complex. And even in our own constitution, the amendment says, you know, slavery is abolished everywhere except for put people in prison. And, you know, that condition, that state of affairs itself created an opportunity to exploit a whole generation of former slaves who became something worse than sharecroppers. They became free labor again for no bigger crimes than being unemployed. And a system created that. And that system hasn't changed a whole lot when you look at how disproportionate the population on the inside suffering in that way still is and how much it looks like it was designed to look like in the very beginning. You know, a lot of people think the system is broke, but if you really pay attention, it's not broken. It's doing exactly what it was designed to do. You know, so the goal, I think, in a post-pandemic positive experience, an improved normal would be changing the system from the inside, if not dismantling the whole thing altogether.
Yeah, one of the things that you've also looked at, and that discussion reminds me of issues of representation and how people are portrayed and thought of. And one of the things you've done, in addition to your poetry, is to curate really a huge collection of African-American comic books and action figures and things related to superheroes. And I wanted to ask you just about that really quickly. And in fact, this has come into some of your poetry in things like in your About Flight work, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the focus in that work is, or in the superhero work, is representation. It's focused on types of masculinity as well. But it's also focused on community. You've talked in interviews about how this represented some lessons in community. Could you talk about that for a second?
Well, it seems like there's 10 questions and all of that. I guess reaching back to the place of comics and characters and heroes, heroic African-American characters, for me, extends back to my childhood and reading and our economic situation. You know, my first home library consisted mostly of comic books because they were a dime each, maybe 15 cents for a special edition of something. So it was easy to find a few nickels to put together to purchase a book. I think that early commitment to literacy, you know, changed my life. At the same time, it also reflected an interest that never really went away. You know, it also allowed me to pay attention to things like, you know, the role of Black people in these comics. Why were they the way they were? You know, why were there, when people of color appeared, they were only assistants or sidekicks or automatically the villains. You know, there were almost no Black superheroes in the early things I was reading. And when I finally found them, when they appeared in the late 70s in the form of Luke Cage and the Black Panther, it changed everything about comics for me. You know, suddenly they were about me and my community. The same people I grew up with and lived with that I could not find in those books were now starting to appear. So that was a thing that was important to me.
And if you were to imagine a world filled with the kinds of people you're seeing in those comic books, kind of people represented in those narratives, and I'm thinking how they relate to the community, what would a world like that do? How would those folks handle what's going on now?
I wish it was just about the people, but I think it's been proven that in a democratic system like ours, ripe for manipulation, that even the majority of people speak, they don't always get their way. I mean, I'm referring, of course, to how we vote in this country and how it oppresses certain populations, how manipulating the voting machine allows a certain group of individuals to stay in charge all these years, and how it's propped up a system that allows those same individuals to prosper. So I think that most people, I want to believe that most people are already reflected in those books. But who we let off the hook when we ask that kind of question is the leadership and people running the system. You know, I think that we can't say it's the people's will and walk away and say it's representing our democracy when we know how corrupt the machine is. We know that voting itself is being manipulated. You know, what I love about this new day is what happened in Kentucky recently with around voting. I mean, it's my understanding we broke records for voting by making excuse-free mail-in ballots available. Now, if we could go beyond that to make it permanent and also add, you know, changing the time from 6 to 6 p.m. Like most, you know, make it longer, make it later. Make voting day a holiday to give people a day off so the people who have to work and can't get off have a chance to vote and participate in the democratic process. I mean, there's so many things we could do to make it a more democratic process and to make it a real, feel like a real community. But we're not there yet. We haven't figured out how to break the machine and fix it. But I think we're close because I think we have a second chance because at the rate of these new COVID infections, you know, we might be moving towards a second wave of shelter in place, which would give us a chance, hopefully, to be even more human.
Yeah, and so then it's a, you know, in your vision, then we really have to have a system that allows you to be a superhero.
And encourages such a thing and encourages all manner of superhero, you know, and without any limitations to ability or gender or race or sex or ethnicity or sexual preference. I mean, that's the community that I want to live in.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Frank. This has been a conversation with Frank X. Walker, former poet laureate of Kentucky and professor at the University of Kentucky. Thank you very much, Frank.
Hey, thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
On next week's edition, The Time Has Come, Kentucky's 650,000 public school students are about to begin a year required to wear masks, have their temperatures taken, and keep their distance from each other and everybody else in their school buildings, playgrounds, athletic facilities. Some school districts may begin with in-person classes, while others will begin with remote instruction. And the state's new Commissioner of Education, Jason Glass, arrives to an overflowing plate of priority issues.
COVID-19 reopening, the economic impact from that, anti-racism and equity work that's really important in the state that needs to be done. And then longer range, thinking about how we can transform and change the education system in the Commonwealth so that we are really preparing our kids for a globally interconnected and lightning fast world and economy.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.